When we started writing our thoughts down on paper, it opened up endless possibilities. Ideas could grow beyond the borders of the mind, and it changed the world. Somewhere along the way, we lost touch with paper, distracted by devices made for every purpose except for thinking and focus. On edge, waiting for the next notification. But what if new technology didn't pull us away from paper, but brought us closer to it? Listen. That's not paper. It's the sound of the new Remarkable Paper Pro, rewriting the future. A paper tablet with a true color ink display, gentle reading light, and unheard of tactility. With digital features for taking notes, thinking, and organizing, without any distractions. Paper is about to change the world again. Get your paper tablet at remarkable.com today.
You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. This week, as we hit the 175th episode, I'm delighted to welcome back Scottish investigator and author Malcolm Robinson. Malcolm has been at the forefront of British Fortean research, investigating the Loch Ness Monster, the paranormal, and ufology for over 40 years, and yet his appetite and passion for these subjects remains undiminished. Malcolm and I cover three of his most recent books, The Incredible Story of the Sorkey Poltergeist, and the information that he has uncovered to show that this case deserves to be one of the best known poltergeist infestations in the world of the paranormal. We then hop across the Irish Sea with his book Please Leave Us Alone, which deals with an investigation in Ireland where a family is seemingly tormented with all kinds of strange occurrences. And then we finish off with a compelling, and in cases, a very disturbing UFO case that occurred on the A70 in 1992, in which two men encounter something that changed their lives forever. It was a pleasure having Malcolm back on the show. I'm sure you'll find our conversation deeply interesting and a little perturbing. But as always, before we get to the interview, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for my Patreon at $4 a month. You can find us at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters or by clicking the link in the show notes. A big thank you to my three new Patreons, Cynthia, Nightbird, and Spooky Sailor. Thank you, and welcome to my Patreon. As always, you can find Mysteries and Monsters across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. We're also on LinkedIn, and you can also find the mysteriesandmonsters.com website, where you'll find the latest episodes, news, updates, and links at the top of the page for merchandise. As always, thank you to Dean Bestel for his wonderful artwork. The show is, as always, produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. So, let's join my guest, Malcolm Robinson, to look at three remarkable cases that he has pulled out from his extensive files for our enjoyment. It's been a while since we dove into the frightening side of the paranormal, so it's a long overdue return to the world of hauntings and more. Joining me is another returning guest, Malcolm Robinson, to discuss some startling cases, including a classic from the 1960s and a current investigation. With over 40 years of investigating a variety of strange phenomena, Malcolm is one of the leading lights in the British Fortean scene. Malcolm, a long overdue welcome back, sir.
It's great to be back with you, Paul.
So you've recently recamped back up to your native Scotland, and yet it seems that your productivity and your thirst for the strange continues unabated, Malcolm.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a passion, of course. It's been with me all my life, and it's still with me now. I mean, I was 23 years living in England, and up until last year, I came back to Scotland last year in 2021. But the passion's still there, Paul. It's burning bright, and we've got a lot of projects on in Scotland now that I'm back, and a lot of lectures, a lot of work and stuff. And yeah, I wouldn't have it any other way. It's just great to be involved in such a wonderful subject of UFOs and the paranormal. It's just magnificent.
For me, Malcolm, you're one of the few people in the UK, I think, who looks at a wide variety of phenomena. And often people will tend to concentrate on hauntings or ufology or cryptozoology. And you've kind of chased everything you possibly can over the years that you've been out there investigating. And I've often been amazed at your continued appetite for these subjects. And I know you recently retired, and it's as if this has kind of given you a new lease of life in regards to allowing you the focus and the drive to really sort of get your teeth into some of your favourite cases that you've been working on over those years.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I've been in full-time employment more or less since I left the school back in 1972. And it was only until just over a year or so ago that I actually retired. I was working for a company in Hastings called Positive Impact to make the manufacture various things, you know, to deal with contact lenses and a whole range of different things. And now, and I could only really, you know, do research and do stuff at the weekends, because when I finished Monday to Friday, the time I got home and the bus, it was late at night and you're tired and you're getting your tea and you're watching the telly. The week is gone. You've only got the weekend. Now I've got so much time. It's fantastic. So retirement suits me. I've no excuses. I can crack on with books and investigations and do lovely shows like Your Good Self, Fear Folk, and that's what it's all about. Fantastic.
Yeah, and I think it's allowed you to sort of really grab the bull by the horns when it comes to this, because you've always been quite prolific. I think your latest book, is it your 11th now?
10th, I think. 10th.
Yeah, we're certainly in double figures, Malcolm, as always. So, yeah. And it's one of those that you seem to have been more prolific over the last 10 years, and like I say, and you've kind of got three books that have all kind of come out in rather rapid succession, two of which were cases that I was very aware of, the Sorky Poltergeist, which for me is one of the most compelling poltergeist infestations in British history for me.
Yeah.
Malcolm, and your book on that is such a hefty tome, and it's just absolutely jam-packed with information and interviews and investigations that it really does surprise me often that more people don't talk about this case as much as perhaps they talk about things in the UK or England specifically, like Enfield and Bawley Rectory.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the South Shields poltergeist far outweighs the Enfield case and Bawley, and what Darren Ritson and Michael Halliwell done with that book, you know, on the South Shields poltergeist is a terrific case. Its equivalent, I guess, probably would be the Sorky poltergeist, because it certainly stands head and shoulders above any other case, certainly in Scotland, you know, due primarily to the witnesses, the high standing academic witnesses that was there, from ministers, Church of Scotland ministers, from the local clergy, from the local doctors, the school teacher, the school children. Each and every one of them saw these unbelievable events that transpired in the small town of Sorky in central Scotland. And I just knew that I had to get a book out about that case. Now, admittedly, Paul, I was 3 years old in 1960. That's giving away my age there. And so I never really got a chance to get involved with it until I was in my teenage years, you know, in 1984, 1987. And 1997 and 2020, I did more investigations. That's when I pulled up the roots of this case and found out a lot more, yeah.
I think it is remarkable, because often when we talk about these cases and people will look at them in a very sceptical slant, Malcolm, they will always kind of say, well, it's just kids mucking about and things. But when you look at the body of evidence, and as you refer to there, the number of witnesses, the people of high standing that were involved in Virginia's case, I I'm still perplexed that people just dismiss these as childish pranks and games and people just misunderstanding things. Because often I think, Malcolm, and maybe you might agree with this, you might disagree. I think when I've spoken to one of your fellow Scots, Evelyn Hollow, she was very sort of protective about the fact that often these cases involve very salt of the earth people, working class families with very kind of normal lives. And often it's as if they're being dismissed because of who they are and where they come from, rather than the actual events that they're being involved in.
Yeah, that can be the case. You know, people look at the primarily who's the main principal witness in this, how sound of mind are they, et cetera, et cetera. And that's fair enough. That's viable questions, you know, people got to ask about, not just when it comes to poltergeists. Same applies to ghosts and also UFO sightings as well, of course. Mm-hmm. But in the main, you know, there's no smoke without fire. In this field, in this wonderful paranormal field, you'll always get charlatans. You'll always get people out to pull the wool over your eyes. And myself, your good self as well, Paul, and our colleagues, it's our job to find out, you know, who's telling the truth and who's not. You know, is it smoke and mirrors, etc.? But certainly, I would never have written a book about the Sorky Poltergeist if I didn't honestly feel that the veracity of the evidence is outstandingly incredible. And how I wish I had been older at the time. You know, I actually really participated in it, you know.
Yeah, well, I think it is one of those things when we look back at these cases. I have a similar thing when I think about Enfield, because obviously that completely missed me because of my age. And it's one of those things that often there are incidents that have happened here in Sheffield where I was around at the time, Malcolm, but I wasn't really paying much attention to the Fortean world as it was at that particular period. I was too busy having fun in my 20s, shall we say.
Of course, yes.
Not that chasing ghosts wouldn't be fun or looking for strange UFO incidents over here at all, Malcolm, wouldn't have sort of got me going and got me out there. But it's one of those frustrations, I think, sometimes that when we discover cases like this, like you say, we often wish that we were smack bang in the middle of it. Yet, I think because Sorky was so well reported and the people involved in it were of such high standing, it's kind of given us such a great tapestry of information to work from that even at this point, and the way that archives are run and information being available, I think it just shows just how prevalent and long-standing this event really was.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the history of the Sorky Poltergeist is well known, not just here in the UK, but overseas as well. The one thing, Paul, the one thing that I'd love to get done would be a docudrama of the Sorky Poltergeist. We had it with the Enfield case, as you know, we had a drama on BBC television. And if we did sort of a period drama of the wee girl coming over from Mobile in County Donegal to Scotland, the things happening in her house and the happening in school, etc., that would just be wonderful. And even though I've got a lot of media contacts, and one contact has shown an interest to do that, but he's went very quiet of late, so I'll have to chase him up. But that's one thing that remains to be done. Not necessarily a big motion picture, but I'd be more happy with a docudrama for the television. That would be wonderful if we could get that done.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think if we only look at what's happened recently with the Battersea Poltergeist,
uh-huh,
and Danny Robbins' work on that really, because it was quite funny, because I ended up interviewing Evelyn about that, primarily because of her appearance on there, Malcolm.
Uh-huh.
And I've got to know her quite well. And she's a fantastic woman and a deeply thoughtful investigator and has some incredible ideas and theories on the whole world of poltergeists and hauntings in general. And
yep,
we were both laughing because obviously we both got a deep interest in the paranormal. So when we were talking about the Battersea Poltergeist, there is another Battersea Poltergeist case that we were both, when it first came to prominence, we were both thinking, oh, well, it's that one that Harry Price investigated. So once again, it's one of those when you look back on it, because it's not that far away from what happened with Sorky, because I think it's only like 5 or 6 years. And obviously this one kind of straddles what went off with Virginia up in Scotland.
Uh-huh.
That's another one where you've got reams and reams of newspaper reports and interviews with people that you just stand back and you think, well, why is it taking 60 years for this to be as well known as it is?
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, back in the day, people were more reluctant to come forward with these incredible tales. There were not so many television stations on the go at that time. Now we're in a plethora of different TV channels now, and it's on the television nearly every night on Sky, different stations, etc. And it's bringing the poltergeist and the UFOs and the ghosts of the world to a new generation of young kids growing up grasping this. When I stayed in Scotland and the first time round, there were hardly any UFO or ghost groups at all, just apart from our own.
Yeah.
And, you know, now there's hundreds of them, you know. It's like everybody wants to be a ghost chaser and that, which is fine. But I sometimes question the credibility of some of these people. And is it just for, look at me, you know, I'm in the paper, and or is it something else? But each to their own. Far be it from me to deny anybody the desire to get out there and spend nights in haunted houses, because it's a wonderful feeling. Nine times, if not 10 times out of 10, nothing happens anyway.
Yeah.
But that one time, it blows your socks off when it does happen.
Yeah. I mean, for anybody that's not aware of Virginia Campbell's case, Malcolm, can you just give us a brief overview of what went on and some of the outstanding collaborative supporting evidence for this? Because I think often when we think of these cases, one of the things that really always made this one stand out for me is it wasn't just happening at the home she was living in. It was one of those weird incidents where it seemed to follow her to a couple of locations as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the story is a massive story, and I'll try and be brief. The story started in October of 1960 when 11-year-old Virginia Campbell was told by her mother and father that they're moving to the small village of Sauchie in Clackmannanshire in central Scotland. Sauchie is about roughly 9 miles from the next biggest town, which is Stirling, and about 20-odd miles, the next biggest town, maybe Glasgow. So it's in the central belt. And at home, her life was in Moville in County Donegal. She didn't want to move to Scotland, but you know, it was all set in stone. So the upsticks, the father remained back in Moville to sell the farm. So it was just herself and her mother, and they came over to Sauchie to stay with some relations there in Park Crescent. And no sooner had she I mean, it's incredible, but no sooner had she, in the first week when she was there, for instance, November the 22nd, 1960, Virginia and her sister, Margaret, had gone to bed, and Virginia's aunt and uncle were downstairs. And when both girls were in bed together, they heard scratching noises and rapping noises and banging noises and then footsteps walking along the linoleum floor. At that, they were terrified. So what happened was they just got out of bed, bounded down the stairs, and as they went down the stairs, Paul, it was like a sound of a heavy medicine ball. Those big medicine balls you got in schools back in the 1960s, going thump, thump, thump behind them.
Mm.
So they ran into the living room and screamed out that there was something strange going on in their bedroom. Her mother and her mother's sister, etc., says they just thought it was childish imaginations and just trying to stay up that extra bit longer. So they chased them back up the stairs, but as the parents took them upstairs, they heard the headboard, and they saw the headboard of Virginia's bed rattling and moving and banging and stuff. And so they decided to separate both girls. And so Virginia stayed in that bed and Margaret went into the other bed, and still the bangings and knockings transpired. It was just incredible. They just didn't know what was going on. You know, it was absolutely astonishing.
Mm.
And I think it was November the 23rd, 1960. Virginia was obviously traumatized by all these things that had been happening. So they kept her off school, and she was sitting in the living room, and suddenly a sideboard, which was next to Virginia, slowly moved out into the middle of the room and stopped and went back the way, and that was in full view of her mother and everybody else. And that night, when everybody was in bed, there were loud knocks and bangings heard from all over the house, and would you believe, even from the next door neighbours. So things got that bad that they actually had to seek the services of the local minister, and his name was the Reverend T.W. Lund. And whether he believed in these things or not, we don't really know. But clearly, when he attended the family home, he went up to Virginia's bedroom and he heard the bangings and rappings himself. So he knew this was something mysterious. He ensured that Virginia wasn't playing tricks, that it wasn't her doing it herself. And then obviously the local doctor, the local GP, a gentleman by the name of William Logan, attended the house. And guess what? He too observed these knockings and rappings. And he actually held the bedstead and it was vibrating in his hand. It's absolutely incredible. Now, whilst he was there, there was this large linen chest, Paul. Back in 1960, they had these linen chests. It was quite long, and they tended to keep the throws, the bed linen, extra bed linen, pillows, etc., in there. And that was against the wall. And then suddenly, that moved across the linoleum floor, and about 27 inches, it moved across the floor and stopped. Then went back again. Then the lid, this long lid of this linen chest, rose up and started fluttering up and down in full view of Dr. Logan. He just couldn't believe what he was looking at. It was absolutely astonishing, you know.
Yeah.
Another thing that happened then as well is when Dr. Logan suggested to Virginia's niece, Margaret, I think I said it was her sister earlier, it was her niece actually. He said, look, you better go and sleep beside her. A massive burst of intense knockings and bangings were heard. And this was more or less the kind of catalyst of what was happening in the Sauchie home. It was mostly the bangings and rappings. Now, as I said, I was only 3 years old at that time, and I wish I'd have been there at the time, but the main researcher on that case was a guy called Alan Robert George Owen. Now, he played a large part of in the development of radar technology during the Second World War. And following the war, he went on to become a research fellow. He was a lecturer in mathematics and genetics at Trinity College. But both George and his wife Iris were mainly interested in researching psychic phenomena, more so poltergeists and psychokinesis. So he was dispatched up to Sauchie. He interviewed many of the people involved, and I think he said something, I think it was, it seems evident, he said, that the physical phenomena observed by the key witnesses are incompatible with trickery by Virginia or by any other children or adults. That was more or less his mainstay. Now, some of the other disturbing events, and I'm only skimming the surface here, Paul, was whilst Virginia was lying in bed, the pillow next to her that pressed right down like a secondary invisible head was pushing down into the empty pillow beside her. And now Dr. Logan also stated that he saw the pillow under Virginia's head spin round fast 90 degrees. And he also said that Virginia's bed covers rippled, and it was like as if you had a stone, Paul, and you threw it into a mill pond, you get the concentric ripples.
Yeah.
Well, that was like a bed covers. Now, he observed that Virginia, admittedly, she did have her arms underneath the pillow, but her arms were by her side. She wasn't, you know, fluffing about with her arms to make the pillow and the covers go like that.
Yeah.
So this was clearly something else as well. Now, when Virginia's father, as I said, he had stayed back in Ireland to sell the family farm. When he came back from Ireland and he was told about these incredible things, initially, you know, he poo-pooed it and he didn't believe it as he would. But sadly, or no, he became part of it as well, because he claimed that an apple floated out of a fruit bowl in the living room. And also when he went into the bathroom, there was a shaving brush floated out of the bathroom and fell at his feet. So he was quick to realise that something was amiss here. Not only that, Paul, there was a Brillo pad. And I can remember all these things because I know the case so well. A Brillo pad floated out of the kitchen and came into the living room. Can you imagine? You're sitting there in the family home and this Brillo pad comes dancing into the living room. Crazy. And Virginia was using a Hoover one day and it suddenly switched itself off. But, you know, nobody switched the switch off. It did it itself. And then the rubber part of the handle flew off and smacked into the wall. And at that point, a clock, which was on a living room cabinet, came off the cabinet and hit Virginia square on the nose.
Oh.
So some of the most incredible, bizarre stuff that was happening, though, Paul. And it's a wee bit smacks of The Exorcist to some degree. Was it does that strange writing appeared on the faces of both Virginia and her cousin Margaret, and also Virginia's lips were seemed to glow red. And here's something else that's quite bizarre. Virginia's bed cover, which was green, was seen to turn red in front of witnesses as well. Now that is pretty bizarre. According to Dr. Logan, there were marks that appeared and disappeared on Virginia's hands, although he did not see this himself. Now, these statements about the writing, the lips glowing red, were contained in a diary by the Campbell family, because Dr. Owen said, look, you've got to document these things. You've got to keep a diary of anything, and even if it's minuscule, you've got to record it. So these things about, you know, the marks appearing on her face and her hands was coming out of that diary. And again, it was just more of the rappings and bangings. But here's where the story changes, Paul. Because it was bad enough that the events were transpiring in the family home. They followed the poor, unfortunate girl to school. Now, what happened here was, and I'll be very brief, if you can imagine the schools back in 1960s, they had, upwards of 30, 40 kids in the classroom then, big blackboard on the wall, and the teacher, Margaret Stewart, had given the class an essay to do. So everybody's all busy writing heads over the essay. They're all scribbling down. They're all preoccupied with this essay, apart from one little girl. And of course, that was Virginia. She had her forearms pressed down on the desk lid. And the teacher shouted up the classroom, Virginia, what are you doing? Stop that at once. It's not me, miss. It's not me. Stop it. And as soon as Virginia raised her forearms off the desk lid was fluttering up and down of its own accord. And then a desk, which was empty, nobody was sitting next to Virginia, nobody was there, it rose up 4 or 5 centimetres off the ground and clattered back down. Then on another occasion, now, Paul, I interviewed over the phone Margaret Stewart, the teacher.
Yeah,
she's passed away now. And this is what she said to me. She says, Malcolm, I didn't even know what a poltergeist was. I hadn't even really heard about the word. I was just naive about all this. And then she went on to say that on another day, Virginia approached her desk, a big, her desk at the school teacher's desk. And she went, there you go, ma'am. There's my essay, and plopped it down on the teacher's desk. At that point, there was a long cane, which was lying flat on the teacher's desk, started to vibrate as it's lying down. Then it actually stood up vertically and thump, 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 thump down in front of the full view of a 30, 40-odd kids in the class, and clattered to the ground. And out of the whole socky, bizarre phenomena, what I'm going to tell you next is the most crazy thing that happened, because the teacher was sitting behind a big desk. And let's be honest, 1960, these were big, strong desks, big wood desks, you know. And suddenly it rose up three, four, five, 6 centimetres off the ground and spun round. Now, where the teacher's stomach was behind the long part of the desk, her stomach was now in this narrow part of the desk.
Yeah.
And at that point, there was a vase of flower bulbs lifted up off a desk and smashed onto the wall. Now, you can imagine, Paul, at this point, the kids are gone crazy.
Yeah.
All this is happening in front of these screaming kids. So the teacher says, okay, let's all go out into the playground. Let's go to the playground.
Teacher.
And the teacher grabbed the classroom door and she says, Malcolm, I couldn't open the door. I was pulling it and I could not open this door. And it was like a big hefty man was at the other side of the door and he saying, you're going nowhere. And then suddenly she almost fell backwards. The door released. And all these kids came tumbling out of this door like a Tom and Jerry cartoon. Trying to get out of this door, you know. And that was crazy. And we even have reports of the family sewing machine, which was unplugged, started all by itself, started, you know, stitching away, and it wasn't even plugged in.
Mm.
Now, as I said, as the years progressed, I interviewed a number of Virginia's classmates, and they went, Malcolm. Malcolm, honestly, God, you should have been there. Now, these are elderly people now, and he says, Christ, I'll never forget it. Now, last November 2021, I gave a lecture on the anniversary of the Sauk poltergeist here in my hometown of Sauk.
Mm.
And I had one of the classmates, and right at the very end of my lecture, a 2.5 hour lecture, I says, ladies and gentlemen, I can do better. We actually have a gentleman who was in Virginia's class. Please step forward and I mentioned his name and he came up and he just told it as it is, far better than I could ever do. And because he was there, you know, he saw this. And I mean, I could ramble on about this case to Kingdom Come, but it's such a magnificent case and I love it to death. That's why I wrote the book. And it's just endemic of what the poltergeist phenomena is. But, and I'm sure you're going to ask me, but I'll answer for you. What is the poltergeist? What constitutes these effects to happen?
Mm.
What I'll tell you, Paul, is this. I don't believe, like most of my colleagues say, is sexual energy coming out of a pubescent young girls or boys, and this energy is externalizing and pushing objects off shelves. What a load of rubbish. If that was the case, Paul, you'd have poltergeists in every single room in the land with young kids, your teenage kids, and all that, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's the bottom line for me is that I believe it is a very nasty spirit that somehow attached itself to Virginia for goodness knows what reason. Oh, before I forget, I know I'm rambling on here, but before I forget, people say, well, where did she go? What happened to Virginia? And what I managed to do in my research in 2020, I thought initially she had went back to Donegal, so I put some, bits of information in the Donegal Times.
Yeah.
I never got anything. And then when we were working with the BBC One show, we went up to Sheila Logan. That was Dr. William Logan's wife. He's now passed on, sadly. And she had a letter from the Daily Mail. And it said that she had went down to Bedford. So I then approached Bedford newspapers. I put some, information in the Bedford Times and also, various Facebook sites, etc.
Yep.
And then I got a phone call from an 82-year-old lady. I won't mention her name on radio, but she phoned me up one night. She says, hey, Mr. Robinson, yeah? Are you looking for the woman called Virginia Campbell? Yes. Yes, I saw your piece in the paper. And she went on to tell me, long story short here, Paul, she went on to say that, yes, she did. She moved from Sauk. She came down with her family to Bedford in England and the poltergeist followed her. Not only that, she's now moved to Kempston. And it followed her there as well. Now, for love nor money, we still don't know where in Kempston. She's married. She's got a new surname. We don't know where in Kempston she is, which is a great shame.
Mm.
Because obviously I would have loved to have got her 20, 21 thoughts from a book. You know, what happened? What do you recall? So we never managed to trace her, unfortunately. And one final thing is that on that lecture that I gave, and I'll be giving the same lecture, well, actually, it's quite diluted, in Hull at the Outer Limits Conference.
Yes.
On the 7th of 8th of May in Hull, Chris Evers. Excuse me. And I'll be letting the people hear the actual sounds recorded of the Sauchie Poltergeist back in 1960. Anybody who's gone to Hull, you will hear the sounds of the poltergeist, so please be there.
Fantastic. Well, I'm hopefully going to be making it there, Malcolm, so I'm looking forward to that, because the last time I went to see your lecture, you let me hold Robert Taylor's trousers. So,
oh, yeah.
So I'm always excited when I see you performing and giving a lecture, so there's always something for me there. I was going to ask that, because often when we talk about poltergeist cases, this is the other thing about Sauchie. When you've uncovered all this additional information, often it's a very short span of time, Malcolm, maybe 9 months, a year, even 18 months, maybe 2 years at most. This is one of these strange cases where it seems to have just been something that's gone on all her life. And regardless of where she's moved from, it's continued to dog her, as it were. And I know when the case first started, people were saying that she was under a lot of stress because she'd moved from Ireland to Scotland, and she was missing her family, and I think she was missing her beloved dog as well. So a lot of people thought there was a lot of emotional stress going on, which, you know, anybody at that age, when you leave all your friends and everything you know behind, that's all you've known for 9 or 10 years, Malcolm, you aren't going to be emotional, aren't you? I mean, it's human nature. There's no disputing that.
Yeah.
And yet, because of the amount of people involved and the fact, like you say, that the incidents that happened at school and the fact that the teacher verified everything that went off, and some of these events are some of the most compelling evidence for any kind of sort of paranormal encounters or events that have gone on, I still find it remarkable that people can sit there and go, oh, yeah, she was just mucking about. Sometimes bad explanations are as bad as you were saying earlier on about people that exaggerate or fake evidence. When you see facts and evidence and witnesses like that, and you just completely disprove it and say, focus on, oh, well, Virginia was moving the covers. Yeah, well, maybe she was. Who's to say that she wasn't? But you can't tell me that she had a string and she was making the linen box dance and she was banging on the walls all the time and she was fooling. As you say, George Owen was an incredibly intelligent man. A deep thinker. And I find it remarkable that everybody was fooled by this young girl to the point that she was able to perform outside of the house in front of 40 people. She would be the greatest illusionist of all time, would she not?
Absolutely. Then another major point that I should bring up to your good self and your listeners all is the fact that the whole street was haunted. We're dealing here with 19 Park Crescent. I can give the address because it's in the public domain. But there were other houses in Park Crescent, that same row of houses, that had admittedly not as massive poltergeist events as Virginia's case at number 19. But other houses, people came forward and were telling me of cold spots, of doors being slammed, of their son seeing a small boy, of a family saying that things were that bad, he was going to sleep, take his wife and his kids to sleep in their car. This is all in this same street, you know.
Yeah.
And I've also been asked, well, what is it? Did the houses used to be built on a graveyard? What's the possibilities here? So we did some look back at some aerial reconnaissance photographs, pre-drones, of course, back in the late 40s, early 50s, before those houses were built.
Yeah.
And it was just fields. Farmland, nothing else, no cemeteries, no, you know, nothing like that. It was just normal fields. So it makes one wonder, you know, okay, we're talking about Virginia here, but we're talking also, and I'll say this in Hull under my lecture, of other houses in that street that were plagued by ghostly manifestations. It's bad enough for one house, but to have it in a number of houses in that street is incredible, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I just think it's a captivating case. And one that anybody who has a love of the paranormal and poltergeist in particular should clearly add your book to their collection, because the amount of evidence and newspaper reports and witnesses that you've spoken to, it just really shows you that one explanation is, it's one of those cases where, yes, you might be able to explain one part of it or a couple of portions of it, but you simply have to look at the body of evidence, and it just leaves you scratching your head because these events are absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, although we've managed to track down the audio recordings of the Sauchie Poltergeist sound,
yes,
what we're still missing is the cine footage. It was taken by Dr. Logan, and that was sent down to London Weekend Television when they were doing a program, excuse me, of Poltergeist. And I wrote, long story short, I wrote, LWT is no longer there, it's moved into other realms, ITV network. And when I chased down somebody who was aware of that program and the possibility that Virginia's story was going to be contained therein, he says, "No, Malcolm, sorry, that program was aired, but we didn't feature the Sauchie case. We don't know where the cine footage went to." And it's a great shame. It's horrible to think that cine footage maybe lying in a dusty drawer somewhere in the corridors of ITV, you know, and it's such a shame that we can't track that down. But we certainly have the sounds of the poltergeist. I mean, nothing fantastic, admittedly. It's just knockings and bangings. And you can actually hear young Virginia scream, "Mommy, Mommy," when these knockings are happening. But cine footage, boy, I would love to get found out.
Oh, well, fingers crossed. You never know, Malcolm. I think we both know enough about culture and history of TV and things that, and music especially, where things that may often seem lost for decades magically appear in somebody's garden shed or something.
Well, that's true. Yeah, it's amazing where things turn up. But let's hope so.
Absolutely. I'm just wondering how many more episodes of Morecambe and Wise can we find in garden sheds, because they, and attics and things like that, because they seem to pop up once every 5 or 6 years, don't they?
It's crazy, because when you think about these wonderful shows back in the day, a lot of them actually got erased. Meaningfully erased, you know. We'll just use the tape again for the next show.
Yeah,
erased in history, you know, Doctor Who and other stuff like that.
Yeah, it's crazy how some things survive and some things don't, even though it was all going on at that time. I think it was just good luck often for some of these older shows.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Well, as you were saying, Virginia originally came from Ireland, and this next case I want to touch on is remarkable in the aspects of everything that seems to be going on. And I'm very interested in regards to this because of your experience and the number of years that you've been investigating paranormal phenomena and strange events, Malcolm.
Yeah.
The book that came out towards the end of last year is called Please Leave Us Alone, which features the story of two women, Patricia and Amanda,
yeah,
who moved from America to Ireland. And it seems that, as we were saying about what happened with Virginia and the fact that things have continued to follow her regardless of where she's been, I'm often consider the aspects of, rather than haunted locations, certain people on this planet can find themselves haunted as an entity, as themselves, Malcolm. And it seems that wherever they go, whatever they do, strange things will always be with them because of the type of person they are. Now, some people might think that's a strange idea, but as we've said in regards to Sauchie and some of the other cases, I think when you look at incidents like this where it doesn't matter where they are or what happens, weird things continue to occur. It's, for me, it's the only really plausible explanation, that it's the person that seems to be the focus of whatever's going on, regardless of the location.
Yeah, I would concur with that. There's certain people who just seems to be like a battery when it comes to paranormal phenomena. And clearly, Patricia, the mother, and Amanda, the daughter, were these two people, because it's been with them all their lives. You know, even when they stayed in Massachusetts in America, they had strange things when she was a young child. She was found, she was found outside her cot. She was staring at the ceiling, claiming to see these strange shapes, etc. And then, of course, they moved to Ireland, and things just went through the roof when that happened. So there is these certain people that seem to attract these phenomena, and they're like, you know, psychic batteries, for want of a better word. The story goes that I first became aware of that in 2011, and Patricia started to email me about what has been going on, And, you know, she was saying that she'd been seeing the greys in various shapes and sizes. They've also claimed to have seen reptilian beings and also other strange creatures in the family home, including tall white beings and more crazy, I've got to say, I won't leave anything out, beings that resemble blobs of water. There you go, I've said it. And also the orbs, various blue, green, red orbs. And she sent me videos of these orbs. Now, as anybody that knows me will know straight away that I don't believe in orbs. I think the vast majority are dust molecules, water vapor molecules. When you've got a number of people going across a carpet with a flash photography, the dust rises up. Now, admittedly, Paul, admittedly, not all orbs are just dust molecules.
Mm.
And I've seen some astonishing kind of videos, and more so the ones sent by Patricia. And so these are kind of hard to understand and get your head around for sure. But they have this ability to actually, they call it the sky family as well. You know, they've been out the back or they've been in a local field and they see these orbs and then they come down. They ask them to come down in their minds and these things come down. But it's more of the kind of terrifying things that's happened, you know, throughout their life. And probably started, I guess, says probably about 1989. That's when she said, Malcolm, that's when things went off the scale, you know, all with the paranormal experiences. They woke up, they had scratches on their feet and their legs felt cold. There was a duvet that was pulled off the bed, etc. And I've got to say this as well, you know, I never ever don't tell the full story, and what this may be upsetting, but she said on one occasion she woke up and she felt like something was copulating with her. I won't leave that out just because it sounds preposterous. She said that. Now, admittedly, with any given case, of course, you have to be wary, you have to be skeptical, you have to, you know, says, these people tried to pull the wool over my eyes. Are they trying to look for notoriety, this, that, and the other? And that applies to any given case, you know, ghosts, UFOs. And as a researcher, your good self, you know that. You have to quiz, dot the I's, cross the T's, whatever, and try and get to the truth. And sometimes when a case of this magnitude comes along, it's like, so much is going on. Can this really, really, really be true?
Mm.
And I've always said in my lectures, you know, you should never ever throw the baby out with the bathwater. And what I normally say on programs such as this or to my lectures, I say, look, just because something looks and sounds ridiculous doesn't mean to say that it is. Because we laughed at John Logie Baird and the invention of the television. Oh, that'll never work. Or we laughed at the Wright brothers' first flight at Kitty Hawk. That contraption will never fly. Oh, sorry, it's flown. So, you know, we got to, you know, we should laugh at these things. And that's why I waited a good while before I decided to write a book about Pat and Amanda's experiences, because I wanted to really digest it all and come to an understanding, because they've had exorcists trying to bless the house. They've had ministers of all denominations come to the house trying to clear it, and nothing has worked, you know. And it's they've had Irish investigators from paranormal societies out. Nothing seems to work, you know. And it's quite frustrating for me to get this. But what they claim to see is, and that's the nature of the book, is a heart map.
Yeah.
Now, and shadow people. Now, I'm sure your good self and your listeners will be well aware of what shadow people are. That in effect, they're more like kind of ghosts, fleeting ghosts that you see at the corner of your eye. The Hartman's slightly different. He stands allegedly in the corner of a person's room. He wears like a fedora type hat, a big long cloak. Sometimes you can't see his face, or sometimes the face is totally blacked out and it's two red menacing eyes.
Mm.
And he really frightens the bejesus out of them, you know. And the thing is as well that Patricia and Amanda have had family and friends to have also witnessed this phenomena as well. That's why it was important for me to get that into the book. Now, admittedly, we are using pseudonyms because a lot of people say, Malcolm, please, I'm happy to tell you what really happened, but by God, I don't want my name used, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
That's understandable. So you got to look at that. I think it was in 2014, Amanda and Patricia were watching television. They were having a cup of tea and they had this holy picture of the divine mercy of Jesus, which was on top of the mantelpiece. It started to vibrate. It started to move. Then it came away from its little hook. You know, it was on a string, on a nail kind of thing.
Yeah.
It left that. It floated out 2 or 3 inches from the wall and just smashed down at their feet, which was obviously very disconcerting, as you can imagine. They've also had these strange, I'm just trying to remember off the top of my head, the small, about, oh, I think it's about 18 centimetres, these small creatures invade the bedroom. And I know it sounds crazy, Paul, I know it sounds bizarre, but, you know, like I say, you never throw the baby out with the bathwater. And also their dog, Blaze, has sensed some form of presence in the family home. And on one occasion, they heard it bark, bark, barking. They went up to the bedroom, and there's Blaze barking at a corner of the room, and nothing could be seen. Nothing could be seen there at all, you know.
Mm.
And they've also had this kind of, it's like a fishy, bleachy smell when paranormal events transpire, that this horrible smell pervades the whole room, which is very bad as well. And like any of my books, I have to say, I don't just say it as it is. I always look at alternative explanations, from sleep paralysis to night terrors, various, you know, various other conditions. And when I said to Patricia and Amanda, look, I says, please don't hate me for this, but I've got to kind of end this book by giving the reader an alternative, because some people, it might be a medical thing. Yes. She says, Malcolm, that's fine. What we have to say, Paul, with the bottom line here, it's not, you know, visual hallucinations or anything like that. It's not monetary gain. It's not notoriety. These things definitely, definitely happen without a shadow of a doubt. And sadly, I believe they're still happening just now.
Yeah, I just find this remarkable, as you said, because there seems to be so much happening on a variety of levels. As you refer to there, it's very rare that we come across a case where there's an occasional sexual element.
Mm-hmm.
They don't seem to be reported very often. I had the pleasure of speaking with Barry Taff few months ago now,
uh-huh,
in regards to the Entity case, which is probably the most famous case of that.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And obviously what went on in that particular incident.
Yeah.
And so when I saw that, I think that's remarkable enough. But it's also, as we were saying, Patricia's had these incidents follow her all her life, and it's always been peculiar, even from being a child. And no matter what she's done, no matter who's been to try and help her, wherever she's been, nothing seems to work. And I found that aspect very interesting, that regardless of what they've tried, it just carries on. It doesn't abate for a bit. It doesn't seem to take a break, which sometimes can happen in cases like this, Malcolm.
Yeah, yeah.
It just carries on as though, well, whatever, you can try what you want, I'm not bothered. And yet, I think one of the strangest incidents, I think, did they have a visit from a priest that turned out to not actually be a priest? It just wasn't a person. It was whatever it was.
Yeah, that's right. I believe that's true. They had a meeting. I think Patricia's mother was in hospital, and they went to see her. And this priest came in and they sat by the bedside, and, you know, he was holding Patricia's mother's hand, and he was very kind. It was fantastic. And then suddenly he says, I have to go now. And he left the room, and he walked along a corridor with only one entrance downstairs. And then a secondary priest came in, and, oh, we've just had one of your colleagues there, a lovely priest, just, you've only missed him, he's just left about 10, 15 seconds ago. No, nobody's passed me in the corridor. You what? So this, who the hell was this guy? You know, who was this other priest, and what was that all about? There's also a Saint Faustina. Obviously, they're very, you know, they're very, believe very strongly in their Catholic faith.
Mm-hmm.
A Saint Faustina suddenly appeared on the television screen when the television was off. And they've had missing jewellery and clothing. disappearing in the house as well. So, I mean, it's just endless what's been going on in that family home.
Yeah. Is it one of the first cases where you've come across witnesses dealing with the Hat Man, Malcolm? Because I know it's a phenomenon that seems to have grown in popularity over the last few years, along with shadow people. And I think, as I've spoken with people in regards to these two particular phenomena before, I think it's because people feel more comfortable about talking with them. I've got a friend who I've known all my life. And since I've started doing the, you know, and we've always talked about strange things growing up and having a mutual interest in weird phenomena from a variety of aspects of it, Malcolm.
Yeah.
And it's only since I've started doing the show that he told me his story of an encounter with a shadow person as a child. And, it, you know, like I say, I've known this guy for 40 years. Never told me this story at all till about 18 months ago. And so when I've spoken to other people about this, and I've spoken to other people that have seen shadow people, do you think it's because more people are comfortable coming forwards because these aren't the normal ghosts and hauntings and strange things? Because it seems to me that I can't remember, you know, and I'm no expert, Malcolm, in any stretch of the imagination, but I've read about ghosts and hauntings for decades. I can't remember these reports being very prevalent on this side of the Atlantic in, you know, regardless of cases from the UK or Europe even, where these stories of shadow people and Hat Man seem to have been coming forward.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. I mean, it was in the main, most of these stories of Hat Man and shadow people were coming from Europe and mainly America.
Mm.
And that was why I felt that I had to have a chapter in the book trying to find some other British encounters with Hat Man. And there's two or three in the book, people who's also saw the Hat Man, and they tell about their own shadow encounters as well. And but yeah, I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe people are now coming forward just to say, because maybe there was some kind of fear factor that they wouldn't be believed, because this is not a normal ghost. This is a strange character with a fedora, chubby-like hat, a long cloak, etc. This is something totally different. It was an American phenomenon. It certainly came over to our shores. And it makes me wonder, Paul, how many more cases of this ilk is out there that people may never tell us. You know, we need to find these people. And the only reason that I do write books is simply because to get these stories out. These stories must go out. It's no good me being a researcher and then just going to my filing cabinet and throwing all the stuff in the filing cabinet. These stories have got to get out in the book form. Now, whether people believe it or not, entirely up to them. At least they've got the information. And that's basically why, you're right. I mean, nobody's an expert. I'm not an expert at all about these subjects. I know nothing. And I just love the subject, and the subject has got to be told, you know?
Absolutely. I think it's very interesting as well. I know often people say, well, these people are just suffering from sleep paralysis, Malcolm.
Uh-huh.
And the thing about that aspect of an explanation for me is, I could possibly believe that would be a reasonable explanation if we were sat here and it was the 1940s. Because in those days, most men wore hats.
Yep.
These days, if you see somebody wearing a fedora somewhere, it's odd. It's unusual.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And therefore, I find it weird as an explanation that people say, oh, well, it's just your brain creating an image. But I don't understand, why would a brain create an image of a man wearing a hat? Because if it was, let's be honest, most people, if you see somebody wearing a hat, they're either wearing a cap, like a baseball cap,
uh-huh,
or a flat cap, aren't they these days?
No. Yeah.
You know, when's the last time you saw somebody in a town centre or on the street wearing a fedora? You very rarely see these people. So I don't understand how this kind of latent memory seems to be affecting so many people in so many areas, because it's simply not an image that seems to be very familiar in the modern era.
Totally agree, yeah. I mean, you very rarely, if at all, see that anybody walking down the high street wearing that type of hat. So it makes one wonder, who is this character? Is he a bona fide character? Is he a Deesian from another vibrational level? Did he once live? Is he a concoction of people's imagination? We have to obviously look at other alternatives. Hence, I did that in my book. You know, hallucinations and that. We've got to, because let's be honest, people do see things under drugs, under hallucinations, and we have to sift that through to find out who's seeing what here, because there's a lot of cases people are just purely under drugs, and that's kind of difficult for me, because I have to ask that question.
Yeah.
And I'll have to ask that on Saturday. We're doing another case, and that question is, excuse me, madam, yes? Sorry to say this, but are you on any sort of form of medication just now? And then they'll go, why do you ask that? And I said, I've got to ask that, you know, because maybe it's some form of medication that's making you see these things. And if I didn't ask these pertinent questions, Paul, the skeptics would quite rightly say, Malcolm, you're not doing your job, mate. You never ask those questions. So These are questions you got to ask, and whether you don't like the answer or not, it's up to the person to relay that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a valid point. And as you say, and I don't think you're doing either your research or the witness any favours by ignoring it or avoiding it. Because, you know, through personal experience, I know that there are certain medicines that people use for Parkinson's disease, for example, which can cause compelling and addictive behaviours. And it affects people in very different ways. And they have to have support groups on the NHS here in the UK to help people deal with these side effects, Malcolm and Dan.
Yeah.
There are numerous medications out there across the world that people are taking. Everybody's different. Certain people are going to have an adverse reaction. And some of those people are unfortunately going to perhaps suffer some kind of hallucination. So it's a valid point. And I understand your reticence sometimes in asking these people. But you've got to, haven't you? You've got to be honest with these people, because if you don't, people will just go, oh, well, they're just seeing things.
Yeah. It makes me wonder about the whole aspect of the human mind, though, Paul, because when you look at the American Indians, I forget the name of the herbs and stuff that they mixed together.
Mm.
They went into the spiritual journeys, you know.
Yeah.
They claim to have seen a whole range of different things. I've never tried drugs. I never intend to. But it makes me wonder about what people see on these journeys under these drugs. And I mean, I've spoke to my friends years ago. I played in a band, and they told me they had used stuff and they saw these tremendous colors and things coming out the walls and all that. So how does the brain generate these images? You know, is it like it's like dreams? Everybody dreams, and we see all this strange, crazy stuff happening in our dreams. There's some form of mechanism here that's operating, and as we know, we only use about 10% of the human brain anyway. So they say that these psychics use that other percentage that they can see and hear into a different vibrational level. And just like, you know, cats and dogs can see and hear different levels of vibration as well. So there's clearly something there, but it's a funny old world when, you know, you've got hallucinations, then you also have the real deal as well. You got to sort it all out.
Absolutely. So are you still planning to go over and visit Patricia and spend some time at the property? Because I know you were mentioning that last year when I heard you being talking about this case.
Yes, I mean, they are looking to move home, and hopefully the phenomena doesn't move with them again. And, you know, obviously I aim very much before they do move is to get over to Ireland. And I mean, we had problems with the COVID and traveling, etc. To try and arrange something. Certainly that's something I want to do, yeah.
Fabulous. Well, I think the last case I want to touch on before I let you return to the land of the living, as it were, Malcolm, is your latest book, which concentrates on a fabulous UFO case from 1992. It's one of those cases where you think, man, is it 30 years ago already?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And this is the A-70 UFO incident. And one of the things I love about cases like this is that this features two chaps who I believe were just off to drop some equipment off at someone's house.
And that's correct.
It was a journey that was supposed to take about 30, 35 minutes, Malcolm.
Yeah. Well.
Two chaps, Kerry Wood and Colin Wright. But as is often said when people report UFOs, oh, well, these people love UFOs. They love this subject. They love science fiction. Neither of these two guys had any interest at all in ufology. They weren't interested in it. They didn't read about it. They didn't watch films about it. They were just two normal guys just doing somebody a favour, weren't they?
Absolutely. And sadly, that's the thing with a number of high profile cases. You know, it happens to people with no interest in UFOs. And certainly that was the case with these two guys from Edinburgh. Mm. And it's just, you know, of that August evening back in 1992, these guys are just catapulted into the twilight zone. For any listeners that's not aware of the case, and I'm sure they can't be that many, that on this August evening, 1992, as you said there, Paul, Gary Wood and his friend Colin Wright were traveling from Edinburgh, and they were taking a satellite system to some friends in a small village of Tarbrax. And yes, indeed, the journey should have only been 30, 35 minutes. Now, as they left the built-up city of Edinburgh with the concrete buildings and the tenement buildings, etc., they went down the A70 road. And as that crept away, it suddenly was bordered by fields on either side. You know, you had a little cottage there, there was a reservoir there, and it was just all farmland for as long as the eye could see. And they're travelling down this road, talking about the day's events. The radio was playing softly in the background, and suddenly Colin alerted Gary as he peered through the windscreen of the car. He went, "Gary, what the bloody hell is that?" And both men then saw this three-tiered jet black shiny object, circular object, three tiers, hovering motionless about 40, 50 feet above the surface of the road. Both men immediately knew that this was not a conventional helicopter or aircraft of any description whatsoever.
Mm.
And rather than stop the car and go back the way they went, "No, let's get away, get underneath this thing." And as the car was directly underneath this hovering object, it emitted like a silver shimmering curtain of mist, fell from beneath this object and hit the roof of the car. And as it did so, both men were enveloped in total and inky blackness. Couldn't see their hands in front of their face, couldn't see the dashboard of the car, they couldn't see each other. They went, "Are we dead? What's happening here?" Now, seconds later, but of course we don't truly know if it was seconds later, but in their mind, seconds later, they regained their sight. The car is on the other side of the road, very dangerously. So Gary had to grab the steering wheel and push it back to the left-hand side of the road, and they sped off to their destination of Tarbrax without stopping. When they got there, they knocked on the occupant's door. Took a wee while for Katrina to answer, but when she did so, Katrina says, "Where the bloody hell are you two been? You should have been here about an hour and a half ago." And they proceeded to tell them about what they saw. So they went into the house. They told Katrina and Ian about this crazy thing that they had seen on the A70. They offered them paper to draw, and they drew this object. And that night, and subsequent nights thereafter, both men had these strange dreams of these small grey creatures coming into their dream world. They then found scars on their body that previously were not there. We all know our bodies, Paul. We go in the shower, we go in the bath, we know what's what.
Mm.
Where did these come from? Scoop mark scars. Well, fresh scar. Well, what's this? So Gary says, "Well, who do you turn to about this? Do you go to your doctor? Do you go to the local police? Do you go to the fire brigade? Well, who did you tell him about this?" Because he wasn't aware of the magnitude of the UFO phenomena. He wasn't interested. He had seen the odd thing on the television, like all of us have, but he had no interest. So, to cut a long story short, he initially tried to get in touch with, funnily enough, Bufora, the UFO Research Association.
Yeah.
And they never got back to him. So he ended up finding a book in Edinburgh Library written by the wonderful Jenny Randalls, who's my hero.
Yes.
And sadly, she's not doing so many lectures these days, but my God, I just love going into Sheffield Hallam University to hear her lectures. And in the back of Jenny's book was my address. And so they contacted me, and I invited them over to my home in Tullabuddy in Clackmannanshire near Alloa. And I sat the guys down, they told me their story. And I says, "Guys, look, would you be happy to go under hypnotic regression just to see if perhaps," and it's a big perhaps, guys, "something else may have happened that night?" And he says, "Malcolm, we'll try anything, but your own wives don't believe, you know, they think we're off our heads, we'll try anything."
Yeah.
Now, at that time, admittedly, I did advocate the use of hypnosis as a tool, as one tool. in the area tools to try and get some answers. Now, I know it's got its pitfalls. I know people can lie under hypnosis and please the hypnotist. I know all this. I know that now. I wasn't aware of it back then. But they says, yeah, let's do it. So cutting a long story short, we used a qualified hypnotherapist, Helen Walters, and they took them individually back to that August evening of 1992. And the typical abduction scenario unfolded. And that was the conscious recall, Paul, was only of ever seeing this UFO above the road. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah.
Under hypnosis, this is what happened. The car was stopped. Coming towards the car was four or five small grey creatures, roughly 3.5 to 4 feet tall, pear-shaped heads, large black inky almond-shaped eyes. And Colin was taken forcibly out of the car, and as was Gary. Now, one of the differences to this case as to other European cases is that Gary, I know it sounds bizarre, but I never hold anything back. Rather than get led away by these greys, Gary was placed on a free floating stretcher-like device. Now, these little greys were not holding the stretcher. It was free floating of its own accord. This was one of several strange anomalies that is not consistent with other worldwide European abduction scenarios. So they were taken, presumably, on board this craft. We don't know for sure, but presumably. They were stripped naked, and they were, both men were subjected to some form of medical clinical procedure. Gary, for instance, found himself on this flat raised table. He says, "Malcolm, I couldn't move a muscle. I could only move my eyes." And there was these grey beings at the foot of the bed. One was holding like a pendulum, which was pulsating orange, and he was moving it around my feet. He says, "I felt a terrible pulling inside my stomach, like somebody's hand was inside my stomach, pulling all my entrails, so to speak. And it was really painful." And he remembers seeing this lens-shaped device free-floating several feet above his head in the circular room. He also recalls seeing what he called initially, he says, it was like a pool of liquid shaving gel. This gel you get, the light blue gel you put on your chin, started bubbling up from the floor of this craft, and then coming out of it with one of these small grey creatures came out of this gel. There was also like a can-shaped device about 3.5, if you can imagine a can of beans, but only it's about 3.5 feet tall, quite big.
Yeah.
Rose up from the floor of the craft and started coming to Gary's head height and revolved and revolved and revolved round his head, making a strange noise. Colin was slightly different. Colin initially found himself in a kind of curved chair, and there was also this needle that came down into his eye, and he was, you know, under hypnosis. I was in a lot of the hypnosis sessions, and he was terrified and screaming.
Yeah.
He also found himself encased, if you can imagine a cigar case, it's only about, a couple of inches, yeah? But imagine that as clear perspex, and it's about 67 feet tall. So just shaped like a cigar tube, but about 6 or 7 feet tall. Colin found himself in a chair in one of these containers. He was strapped, he was naked, he was strapped with the arms and legs, and there was a kind of mist billowing around his kind of tube. To the left and to the right of him, Colin says, "Malcolm, there were other people, males, females, all ages, also naked and similar in these containers as well." And probably the most unusual aspect of this case was when Gary says that again he found himself lying down on this flat table. He couldn't move. He says, "Malcolm, I desperately wanted to punch one of these wee guys, but I couldn't for the life of me." And he says that to the left on the floor was a young girl. Now, she had no clothes on. She was sitting on the floor. She had her knees up under her chin, and she had her arms wrapped around her knees. She had kind of shaggy, permed, loose hair, and she gently turned her face towards me, said, and tears were running down her face, and says, "I'll never, ever forget the forlorn despair on that young girl's face.
Oh.
And he actually passed a BBC lie detector test some years later. And the reason why I did this book on its 30th anniversary this year, 2022, was because whilst the case is in one of my first books, UFO Case Files of Scotland, Volume 1, I decided that it needed to have its own book to tell the full story, because I then found hypnosis tapes that hadn't been transcribed since those days, 1992. So I've got all these new transcribed all the tapes. I've got Gary's 2021 thoughts. The book was written last year, of course. 2021 thoughts of what happened. Colin is no longer talking about this case. In fact, he's went off the radar. And then, as a footnote, some years after this case, Gary was travelling in his car, and not in the A70, another part of Scotland, with his two young sons, but again, either side of him, it was just fields. And then suddenly, it was like this white mist rolled up across the bonnet of the car, and came through the windscreen and enveloped the whole car.
Enough.
Both his sons were screaming about Jesus, you know, what's going on, you know, and suddenly it just disappeared. Now, make out of that what you will. Was that another UFO-related experience? Maybe. It wasn't drifting fog on the road, because it was a clear day up until that point. You know, it was early morning where you get that moisture effect.
Mm.
Nothing to do with that. And it's just a wonderful case, and I really honestly felt, Paul, that it deserved its own standalone book, and it was a story that needed to be told.
Yeah. I mean, it is quite a frightening case in the annals of British UFO history as well, Malcolm. There aren't many cases, when we talk about some of the big ones here in the UK, where we have such an emotional response to hypnosis, yeah, and regression. And it's very interesting for me that, as you said at the beginning of describing the case, these two chaps, even their own wives, thought they were making something up, or they'd lost their minds. And I, as we were saying about people wanting a bit of notoriety and a bit of fame, got two guys who've no interest in the subject, who end up becoming the butt of ridicule from their own friends and family. And you think, well, if the people closest to them aren't going to believe them, and they're absolutely convinced as to what's happened to them, it must make the situation a lot worse, because until they'd obviously got in touch with Jenny, they were probably just wondering, what the hell do we do? What has happened to us? And I find it remarkable that, as you say, Gary's still quite open about what happened to him. He'll talk about it. But clearly, as you were describing there, going through the hypnosis sessions, Colin's situation seems to be a bit more full on, because even the very description of that kind of thing is terrifying, really. And to have that kind of memory locked away, because we know when people have gone through these kind of situations, Malcolm, that occasionally their brains will file everything back into its proper order for a brief moment. It must be terrible, because I would imagine that they probably suffered some kind of flashbacks over the last 30 years, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we asked the question, you know, there was much more to the case than I've described here. You know, Gary, for instance, found himself in this cavern, and these strange shapes were coming towards him. But yeah, there's a lot more has happened to him. It is very disconcerting, and flashbacks, yeah, definitely, that they've had that throughout the course of the years. I mentioned about Gary's wife. He's with a different partner now, but Gary's wife at the time, she didn't believe him. And then until one night, I took a phone call, and she says, "Hello, is that Malcolm?" "Yes, Malcolm speaking. Is Gary's wife here? Can I tell you something?" And, "Of course, yeah, on you go." And she proceeded to say that a couple of nights ago, she was lying in bed. Gary was lying beside her sleeping, and she was reading a book. She closed the book, put it down on the bedside cabinet, switched the light off, and about 30 seconds later, small, childlike, cold, clammy hands grabbed her ankles and pulled her forcibly down the bed, whereas her head was on the pillow. Now it's halfway down the bed.
Oh,
she looked out to the bottom of the bed, wondering what the bloody hell's going on here. And because there was the curtains were just slightly open, there was a street light penetrating through the curtains. She could see three small grey beings standing at the foot of the bed. They released the surprise in their face, like, she can see us kind of thing.
Mm.
Released their ankles and wobbled through the wall and just disappeared. She says, "Malcolm, I believe my husband 100% now." Now, she didn't need to say that, and I believe that's true. I don't think she was making it up. She clearly had a traumatized in her voice when she said that. She was trying to go over it, you know?
Yeah. Do you think they got the wrong person?
Good question. I don't know. I mean, people might say that maybe they did. And here's another funny thing. I'm sure you're aware of the abduction phenomena as much as I, Paul.
Mm.
These are so meant to be clever people, clever aliens. Call them what you will. Why on some occasions do they put people back in their beds with either their clothes the wrong way around or they're wearing somebody else's clothes?
Yeah.
What is that all about? You know, it's crazy.
Yeah, sometimes it's the little things. Like, I think, doesn't Gary realise when he's in the car that his seatbelt's unfastened?
Well, I was Colin. Colin, you know, they're very, very careful and this is even in 1992 before it was actually compulsory.
Mm.
They always wear their seatbelts, and Colin's, when these creatures came towards the car, Colin went to unbuckle his seatbelt and he found that it was already unbuckled, and he could not for the life of him understand why that could be. They also claimed to have seen their car on board this craft as well. That is another thing that I forgot to mention. So it must have been a hell of a size of an object, you know?
Yeah. I remember speaking to a gentleman called Tom Reed, who had a famous encounter in the US and outside of the town of Sheffield, ironically enough, in Hillsborough County over there. And he was saying when they were taken and put back, they were all put back in the wrong places in the car.
Yeah.
And I think it was his mum, and his mum wasn't driving the car. And then they were outside a diner and his mum was in the driver's seat, but she couldn't drive.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, you know. I mean, I've got to say that, I mean, I've been dealing with this subject now for over 40 years as a young guy, you know, and I don't have the answers, and I'm not an expert, but it makes me wonder what is going on here. Mm. And I always say, when I speak about abductions, I always say the following, and that is, if these abductions are to take sperm and ova from males and females, why are they still doing it? They've been doing it for over 40, 50, 60, 70 years. Surely they've got enough genetic material now that they don't need to do this.
Yeah.
You've got other people that say, well, they're looking for the soul. These wee greys are not got a soul as such, and they need to know what's going on with the soul and humankind. It really puzzles me and annoys me and frustrates me that these abductions are still ongoing. And not just abductions, you've got cases where people see landed craft and they're poking the grass with these strange rods and taking samples. It baffles me. I do believe that there's something going on, it always has done, but why are they taking samples of Earth, and why are they taking samples from males and females? There's just something going on that I must be missing. I can't for the life of me understand what's going on. There's a lot of researchers who have their own thoughts and feelings, of course. You could have another guest on tomorrow night and he would say this and he would say that, and that's great. Everybody should look out the box.
Mm.
But I don't have the answers, and people think I do, but I don't.
I know, I once heard somebody flippantly say that they're perhaps just on school field trips, Malcolm, and that's why they keep coming back. The same reason why we used to dissect frogs in science class at school, even though we'd all done it, we didn't need to do it, we still carried on doing it, and they just think that this is their school trip for whatever reason.
You know, and you know what? We shouldn't laugh at that, because like I said earlier in the show, you know, we shouldn't laugh at things because it sounds ridiculous, but everything should be put into a hat, and we should pick the things at the hat and really look at under a microscope and say, right, okay, what's going on here?
Mm.
But maybe the phenomena may just show its hand eventually. I would like to think in my lifetime something will happen that we can all know. But again, another thing that we should bear in mind is that we're not dealing allegedly primarily with the greys. We're dealing with reptilians and all these other I never ever speak about the reptilians or the insectoids or this because I don't know anything much about them. What I mean by that is I haven't done any research, I've done research, but I have not spoken to a witness who has experienced that. And until I do, I'm not happy to speak about those. I can only speak about the greys because that's where people are coming to me. Malcolm, I've seen this, I've seen that. And it'd be wrong of me to talk about other things that people are seeing because I don't know enough about it.
Yeah, well, that's always been one of your refreshing points, Malcolm, is you're very comfortable in talking about what you've researched and investigated, but you're also very comfortable in saying that you don't know or you've not covered something. And I always think that stands you in good stead.
Yeah, well, you know, you've got to be honest about these things. And because somebody may have a piece of the puzzle, maybe in Bolivia or Peru or somewhere, and it's just waiting. I mentioned about the stretcher in the A70 case. I mean, they both guys claimed to have seen under the eyes of these small greys, red, yellow and green. Perforations, coloured perforations. As yet, I have never come across another case of that nature. Then you look at Skinwalker Ranch and what's going on over there, and the world is full of mysteries and it's just crying out for answers.
Absolutely. Well, Malcolm, it's been fascinating to talk with you over these certain subjects and pick your brains about your investigations and your research into them. What you got planned next, and where can everybody keep up to date with your work and get hold of a copy of your most recent publications?
Yeah, I mean, all my books are on Amazon. Just type in Malcolm Robinson and you'll see the kind of UFO and ghost and other titles. What's coming up is, well, I'm giving a lecture, as I said earlier, at the Outer Limits conference in Hull on the 7th and 8th of May. I'm the associate editor along with the Chris Evers and Philip Mantle. I'm also speaking to the Scottish Society for Psychical Research on the 19th of May in Glasgow. Then we have, of course, our own big SPI, Strange Phenomena Investigations Conference in Glasgow University on the 11th of June, where there'll be a number of guest speakers there. And I've recently been asked to speak to LAPIS, that's in October, and ASAP has asked me to give a talk to them as well. And I just love talking about these subjects, and just, and it's better in the bar afterwards when somebody back. That's when you hear the real stories, Paul.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully I'll see you in Hull because I'm planning to come over for that because there's a couple of people I want to see. And obviously I know you're going to be there and Paul Sinclair. Peter Robbins is obviously coming over from the States as well. So I'm excited to see Peter in the flesh because he's another one of my electronic friends.
He's a lovely
fellow. He's a wonderful man and a deeply thoughtful researcher as well. So Malcolm, thank you so much. It's been too long. I know it seems, as everything that's happened over the last 2 years, it seems to be a blur and also extremely long. And looking back, I can't believe it's nearly 150 episodes since we last spoke. So hopefully we'll speak again in a shorter time frame, and I wish you the very best for the year, and hopefully I'll see you in Hull and I'll buy you that pipe, my friend.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and all the very best. You're doing a cracking job.